Hello, and welcome to episode number 105 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. While modern ufology has been a component of our cultural zeitgeist for decades and decades now, during much of that time it has generally been seen as a matter for astrophysicists and aviation experts. While groundbreaking researchers such as Jacques Vallée, John Keel, and J. Allen Hynek, as early as the 1970s, suggested the anomalous and highly strange nature of the data takes us well beyond that kind of conventional inquiry. Even today, the mainstream still tends to think of UFOs, now monikered as UAP, and NHI, the fancy new name for what we used to call aliens, as involving interstellar travelers arriving at Earth in sophisticated spacecraft. For many, especially in still physicalist-centric Western civilization, this kind of enterprise represents, at least in potentia, a new kind of contact and a new possibility for communication that takes us beyond what we've been limited to amongst our own species over the millennia. But here again, the data, when one looks squarely into them, takes us well beyond that notion. And that's because contact, and specifically contact with apparently non-human and non-conventionally human intelligences, has supposedly already been happening. The varieties of contact technologies or modalities that have mediated this non-ordinary kind of communication include mediumship, channeling, shamanic journeying, CE5/heis, dreams, psychedelics, and even fever states, and that's just to get started. In other words, the issue seems to be not one of needing to wait for interstellar travelers to arrive to finally give us this opportunity, for it's been available to us all along, with some cultures and people groups being more privy to this fact than others. Interestingly, these various modalities of contact and communication also seem to be possible regardless of what would seem to be the expected language and even species-specific differences. And that's because mind-to-mind communication, known in parapsychological circles as telepathy, seems to be the general rule rather than the exception in these endeavors, thus bypassing the need for translation of written and spoken languages altogether. But of course, these startling revelations raise further questions. If the issue is not one of needing to wait for interstellar travelers to arrive via superliminal, that is, faster-than-light travel, then how exactly is this contact and communication happening? Have they been here in our so-called physical space all along? Or does the nature of this contact suggest space, and for that matter, time, is simply not what we've long assumed? How is it that these various contact technologies are able to connect us with alternative forms of sophisticated sentience, and what do they have in common that makes them effective? These are the captivating and consequential matters we'll seek to engage with in this, the 105th episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. As we begin this week's podcast, I'd just like to remind everyone that if you would like to support this podcast, and in so doing, gain access to all of my content, which includes not just POC, Liminal Frames, and Event Horizon, but also the various feature series I create, as well as OTC Squared, as well as a new feature starting this week called Midweek Meanderings, as well as access to my Discord server and early access and discounts to courses and private retreats, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian or by subscribing on Spotify. All right, with that preamble aside, let's jump into this week's podcast. We're going to look into these different kind of technologies of contact. And just as, if not more importantly, what is it about the nature of reality that makes these kinds of technologies possible? And as I said in the introduction, not only possible, but actually already realized, although among some people groups and some belief structures more than others. Now, speaking of belief structures, of course, every society, every construct that people belong to has within it certain assumptions about the nature of reality. And in our modern day, in Western civilization, the reason why the UFO phenomenon has been put off for so long is that it tends to stretch our assumptions about what is possible. Of course, beyond UFOs, these other elements of non-ordinary contact with beings that seem to be coexisting with us in other domains altogether stretch our modern Western conventions even further, basically to the point where they're not even taken seriously. They're just assumed to be make-believe, fraud, delusion, that kind of thing. But this is, again, where we have to really look at what the data is telling us. Because ironically, what is projected to us from the mainstream is that these kinds of things can't be possible because they don't play well with our understanding of reality. But actually what physics, which tells us about reality, is suggesting is that actually the assumptions we've been working under in modern Western civilization for the last several centuries are simply not true, full stop. And it's only because of that new understanding that undoes our former understanding of reality has not bubbled up to the surface, that is to the general public, that we don't take UFOs and these other kinds of contact modalities with non-ordinary kind of beings, sentience, etc., seriously. And to really underline this point so that we're all on the same page here, I'd like to point to something called the demise of local realism, because this is central to what has changed about our understanding of reality, and the consequences are considerable. And yet again, most people in the mainstream at the surface level are not even aware of these revelations. So what is local realism? It's the idea that objects have definite properties, that's realism, and that information about these properties cannot travel faster than the speed of light, that's locality. In classical physics, it's assumed that objects have well-defined properties regardless of whether we observe them, and that these properties are influenced only by their immediate surroundings. Again, that's locality. But here is the real kicker, and I want us to pause to really ground this, to integrate this into our understanding so that we consider all of these matters in light of this profound revelation. Local realism is no longer believed to be a thing, period. And that's because experiments, notably about testing Bell's inequalities, have shown that quantum particles can exhibit correlations that cannot be explained by any theory that maintains both locality and realism. This means that either particles do not have definite properties until measured, challenging realism, or that these properties are influenced instantaneously over any distance, challenging locality. Now, in previous podcast episodes, I discussed a figure in quantum physics named Nima Arcani-Hamed. He's gone even further. He says that it's not just about locality and realism, but really about space-time itself. What he's saying, and this is even more consequential, is that space-time cannot be foundational. As Donald Hoffman likes to say in quoting Nima Arcani-Hamed, space-time is doomed as a construct altogether. We know it cannot be ultimately real. It's more like a shadow cast by a deeper structure. And again, that has vast implications for the matters that we engage in this podcast, because these other beings coming from seemingly coexistent domains make perfect sense once you do away with the notion that space-time is foundational. You no longer feel like you have to fit everything within space-time to make sense of it. But let's be clear here. The implications of the violation of local realism raise deep philosophical questions about the nature of reality, causality, and the limits of human knowledge. It challenges the classical notion of an objective reality independent of observation and invites new interpretations of what it means for something to, quote-unquote, exist. This is fascinating, and the takeaway here is that we should be asking ourselves what this is all around us that we're a part of. We have long assumed that this is somehow real and substantial, and these other beings coming from these other realms are not really real, or only real in kind of a tangential way. We know now that this is the wrong way to look at it, because we recognize now that this is not what we think it is. Reality is not what we think it is. We're not even sure what it means to exist, quote-unquote, again. This comes around to this notion that consciousness may be primary. I'm being a bit coy there. I think it is primary. And once you allow for that, then a much more interesting kind of cosmic order comes into play, where the dynamism of these different interactions can be mediated by many different kinds of technologies that toggle not the fabric of space-time, which again we know now is a shadow of a deeper structure, but toggle consciousness itself, the interactions, the relationships between different conscious entities within the vast, undifferentiated sea of consciousness. Now, in the past, we've discussed the figure of Donald Hoffman pretty regularly, and he talks about space-time being more like our local headset. So when you play a VR game, you put on a headset, you suddenly have this fully immersive reality that you seem to be placed within. Of course, we know that's not ultimately real, but it can feel that way, can feel very immersive when you're wearing that headset. So basically, the notion here is that space-time, again, which is not the ultimate truth, it's just a shadow of some deeper structure, is what's being beamed through our virtual reality headset. Look at it that way. But some people have slightly different headsets than others, and specifically different people groups seem to have slightly different headsets, which allow them access to broader ranges of reality than other people. And of course, what has happened to those people historically? We've tended to want to stomp them out of existence altogether. We've wanted to wipe them off the face of the earth. We think about people that were branded as witches in the past that seemed to have these capabilities, which again were assumed to be or lumped into the notion of them working in cahoots with the devil, and therefore they were killed because of that. But really what's key here is that they are being targeted because of these augmented capacities they have, that they had a headset that could allow them to contact and interact with other realms of existence or a more expansive realm of existence than the general public. So it's very interesting that in different cultures around the world, not just within Christianity, we see this has happened, where people are targeted and then exterminated merely because they have these capacities, which I would suggest to you prompts some interesting questions. Why is that the case? Why are we so uncomfortable with this notion? Why do we so quickly jump to the conclusion that this must mean they are working with evil forces? On the one hand, you could say that's because of dogma. That's just what they were taught. But what if the possibility exists that that was actually a seeded notion, that a control structure that was trying to prevent human beings from having full access to that broader bandwidth seeded this idea amongst different religious groups and amongst human psychology, period, that would basically seek to stamp out these people? I think that is partly what's going on here. Again, I understand this goes against conventional thinking, which wants to reduce these things to just ignorance and religious dogma. But of course, the question is how much religious dogma or certain ideas within it have been seeded as part of a control structure. I would posit that that's something you should at least consider. I think that is part of what has gone on historically. Now, as you're probably aware, within psychology, there's this ongoing debate between nature and nurture, which speaks to the question around what has caused certain behaviors or tendencies in people. Is it genetic? Is it something they inherited? Or is it something they learned in their environment? And that would be nurture. So one is nature, one is nurture. Of course, what we usually find is that it's a bit of both, and sometimes these things actually compound each other. But all that is to say, with our matter here, the things that we're interested in, we should point out that people do have this innate ability, but they also learn to adapt the skill, make it more fruitful. One person we discussed on this podcast in the past in this regard is Joe McMonagle. So he's someone who was trained in the remote viewing program that the U.S. government was involved in, and he proved to be very effective, very skilled with this kind of protocol, which is underlyingly tapping into clairvoyance, the ability to see clearly beyond your usual senses. But what's interesting is that, as I pointed out before, when I spoke with Joe McMonagle when I was at a retreat at the Monroe Institute a few years ago, he pointed out that he thinks this skill came online for him out of necessity when he was a young boy, living on the mean streets of Miami, lived in kind of the projects in Miami, a poor area that was quite dangerous. And he had to practically, pragmatically protect himself and his sisters. And so in that case, it was very, very important for him to know what kind of danger might lay around a corner. And not just might, but did. He needed to have actual knowledge, actionable intelligence that would make him make one decision, go left versus go right, for instance. So from his point of view, it was an evolutionarily derived kind of capacity that was like a muscle that basically becomes stronger through use because of what he went through as a child. Now, of course, for many of us, with the modern social safety net, which brings many positive things, of course, we are often not put in a position where we need to rely on that kind of sensing, and so perhaps it doesn't develop. So as I've said before, what the evidence seems to suggest is that pretty much all human beings have some element of this capacity to different degrees. But for most people, it's largely dormant. Number one, because we don't use it. And number two, because our modern society has told us it doesn't exist, so we tend to not even notice it when it does happen. Or sometimes even more hilariously, we explain it away even when we see ourselves doing it. This is how propaganda plays a role in how we think about reality. Now, another figure that we've discussed on this podcast in the past, who represents an excellent case in point, is Dan Sherman. So to refresh your memory, Dan Sherman is someone who claimed to have been part of a classified, deeply classified program that basically involved an accord with the Greys, and he was basically used as a go-between to have communication with these Greys and receive certain intel that would be passed up the chain to a very elite group within the Air Force specifically. Now, what's interesting is he went through some training, some pretty extensive training, where he was taken into this underground facility, sat in front of a computer, and had to learn to use his mind to activate changes on the screen in front of him. So again, there we have the nurture aspect of this. He had to learn to develop this skill. But what he realized later on was that his mother, who was an abductee, was actually taken, and then his genome was augmented, edited, while he was still in her womb. So here we have a case where the Greys, or this non-human intelligence, did indeed augment his DNA, his genetic structure. But then later on, 20 years later or whatever, he went into the Air Force, he was recruited into this program, and this skill was further developed so that he could be of use in getting this information from the Greys and then passing up the chain to this really, again, elite group within the Air Force. And he later on, to refresh your memory, came to believe that what he was basically receiving was coordinates, dates, times, that kind of thing, to do with abductions that were going to take place, which suggests, again, pretty provocatively, that the Air Force knew about these abductions, that had indeed agreed to them. This is part of the accords, perhaps, that people like David Grush have alluded to. But again, the key here is that we have both nature and nurture, an inherent capacity, but that in this case was actually augmented by the Greys, and then later skill training actually helped him to even further the effectiveness of this capacity. So thus far, we've discussed a couple individuals who had this kind of capacity that involved both nature and nurture. But as I mentioned in the introduction and earlier on, this also is reflected in people groups altogether. So different ethnicities seem to have different capacities. So again, if we think about the analogy of the headset, different ethnic groups have slightly different headsets, which gives them different access to this broader bandwidth of reality. For instance, one group that's been pointed to pretty regularly is the Cherokee, that different indigenous groups seem to have this broader capacity, and the Cherokee people specifically have been pinpointed in this regard. So what's also interesting here, of course, is that we have as part of their self-understanding of their origin that they actually were coming from star people, that actually they descended from what they called star people. So basically sentient beings that came from outside of the earth that seeded them on this planet. And to some degree, they are the descendants of that group. And that would explain why we have subtle differences, and sometimes not even so subtle differences, between different people groups. Again, speaking of propaganda, the assumption in modern society is that all human beings descended from one people group, and that we basically are working with the same headsets. But I would say the evidence suggests otherwise. And interestingly, this also dovetails with some of the origin stories of some of these different indigenous groups, which again, Western people have tended to reject. They assume those are just silly stories. But the evidence would seem to perhaps suggest otherwise. In fact, not only is this part of the lore that we've covered, for instance, in the work of Artie Sixkiller Clark, who's an academic of indigenous American origin, who's interviewed many different indigenous peoples in North America and South America, and then told those stories in her various books, of which we've covered three so far, with more to come in the future. Not only do we see this notion evidenced there, but there is even evidence that the U.S. government has targeted and actually taken people of indigenous descent and used them in some of these nefarious programs, various mind control programs, and programs that are seeking to find information again beyond the use of our usual senses. So these people have been recognized as being particularly adept at this. And unfortunately, what has often happened is that this is kind of victimizing these people, because some of these people live in very poor conditions in different parts of the world. They are scooped up and given temporary riches, really nice facilities to live in, etc., for their families. But then they are used basically to obtain information in these non-ordinary ways, often where they are being fed huge amounts of different kinds of drugs and medications, which tend to augment their capacity even more, but in the long run really degrade their brains. And we see all sorts of signs of quick deterioration, ultimately resulting in death. And unfortunately, because this flies beneath the radar and there are not people that are championing the rights of these people, this largely goes unrecognized, again, not just because those people groups tend to be marginalized in modern Western society, but also because the activities they're being involved in are not believed to be possible in the first place in, again, that conventional Western society. So this, again, tells us something about reality that's important, and not just about reality, but about human history, human origins, and it being a more complicated picture than we've thus far been told, at least in Western conventional society. Now, thus far, we've talked about people that have either had their genetics altered in some ways, augmented in some ways, in utero, etc. And we've also talked about different people groups, different ethnic backgrounds that seem to have different capacities, or what we might call different headsets, slightly using that kind of metaphor. We now want to turn to the question of how people that are part of the general population can also increase these skills and tap into these things. Because again, as I said earlier, humanity seems to, across the board, pretty much have these capacities. It's just that they're largely dormant in most people, either dormant again or just not being noticed within certain societal structures that don't welcome these kinds of notions. There are different kinds of contact technologies that can be used to facilitate these kinds of contact and communication experiences. The first one we'll discuss is psychedelics. Now, this is something I've covered in other podcasts, so I won't go into too much detail, but generally speaking, I want to give you just some sense of what is actually happening here, how we're leveraging this capacity. So what we understand about psychedelics is they seem to actually not add to our experience, not basically allow us to hallucinate things that are not there, but rather to diminish the function of the filters that our brain has developed in an evolutionary sense, so as to give us access to the more expansive reality all around us. So again, the real key here is that it's not adding something, it's actually just reducing and diminishing the function of the filter that prevents us from seeing more, experiencing more of what's already around us, what's already there. And of course, this makes quite a bit of sense, because when you think about it from an evolutionary point of view, the goal of evolution is not to give us a pipeline into ultimate truth, but rather to give us just enough information to allow us to navigate our environment and keep us alive. And again, as you've heard me reference before, Donald Hoffman would say that basically that has resulted in a headset with icons, if you will, to use that kind of metaphor again, that we use to navigate a reality, an underlying reality that we actually don't interact with directly, but only indirectly through this kind of interface. But again, some of these other contact technologies perhaps do allow us to tap into the underlying structure of reality. So what psychedelics does, again, is it just diminishes the function of the filters within our brain that allows us to tune into what's already there. And this is exemplified, for instance, in how when we look at the brain scans of people on psychedelics who are having really vivid, mind-blowing experiences that seem more real than real, as they're often described, their corresponding brain scans look remarkably dull and dormant, look very static, like not much is going on. And again, according to a physicalist point of view, if you're having a really amazing experience, a vivid experience where your senses seem to be lit up, because again, we assume that we are perceiving through our senses, then we should see this in a brain scan that looks lit up in a corresponding way. But that's not what we see. We actually hear reports of people time and time again having remarkably vivid experiences, the most mind-blowing experiences of their lives. But simultaneously, their brain scans look like nothing is really going on. Neurochemically, they're quite dormant. So again, this hints at not just the fact that reality is more than we are usually aware of, but that perhaps actually what we're usually experiencing is a diminished and translated, dumbed down kind of version of that broader reality. All right, the next contact technology we're going to discuss is what is known as shamanic journeying. So for those of you not familiar, a shaman is a particular person within a tribe that is picked out to play a certain role for the tribe, to fulfill a certain function for the tribe. And the first point I want to make, again, along the lines of what we've been discussing with nature and nurture, is that this is not just any random person. They don't just draw straws and whoever happens to get the shortest straw becomes the shaman. What actually happens usually is that there are certain behaviors that are noticed early in life that suggest this person might have a particular gifting to this end. And so these people are noticed and then they go through a certain kind of procedure to sort of test to see if this person is who they think they are. And if that comes back as true, then they are actually initiated into the role of shaman for the tribe. I specifically say for the tribe because what's key here is that they will play a role where they basically tap into these other kinds of reality in order to obtain actual information, actual intelligence, again, like what I said about with Joe McMonagle, intelligence that can be used to make decisions about the actions of the tribe. For instance, where food is, do they turn west or east? The shaman enters into kind of a journeying experience to obtain information in this specific regard. So it's not just random information or just wild, exciting, kind of colorful, abstract notions. No, this is to actually obtain information that is actionable, that will help the tribe make decisions that will benefit the tribe, that will sometimes be life and death decisions. So again, this is not a matter that's taken lightly. So the person that's chosen to be the shaman already shows certain giftings, which again points to the nature aspect, that this is inherited to some degree. And to that point, just like we see with experiencer testimony and experiencer lore, some of this gifting or tendencies seem to run in families. So often shamans are picked along a line of genetics because that, again, is something that is inherited from person to person to person. They may not have used that language to describe this, one of genetic inheritance in the past, but we do see that certain people within a certain family line are generally picked to be a shaman because of this, which again lines up with what we see with experiencers who often report being part of generations of contact. And again, it's not just contact, but sometimes editing and augmentation of gene structures, which help to explain why some of these people have additional capacities or more augmented capacities beyond the average. So that's a little bit about how a shaman is chosen. But once a shaman has taken on that role, the question then remains, how do they make these kinds of connections? How do they contact these other kinds of beings beyond this realm and obtain information, helpful information that will impact the survival and the livelihood of the tribe? Basically, what happens is it's a combination of what we just discussed in terms of plant medicines, different psychedelics that are used to mediate this kind of crossing over, along with things like a drum. Now, perhaps you might ask the question, why a drum? What does that offer? Is this just about being musical? Well, as it turns out, no, that's not primarily how the drum is used. And the key is how. I used to lead shamanic journeys when I lived in California and have conducted these with family and friends in the past. And basically what you want to do is create a certain rhythm that is repetitive. That's the key. It's repetitive. It's not very colorful. It's not meant to be dazzling for people who are listening and participating in the experience. It's meant to actually drone them into a kind of trance-like state. So that's the key. It's a repetitive rhythm that is used to induce a trance-like state. And why? Because that modulates your consciousness so that you actually are able to expand your consciousness and make contact with these other modes of existence. Again, the question about where we're going is perhaps the wrong question. Remembering, space and time are more like shadows on the wall. We are modulating consciousness through the combination of psychedelics and the trance-like state induced by the rhythmic pattern of the drum, which is repetitive. And it's that combination that allows them to cross over and make contact. And when they do, they can actually ask questions and receive answers. So again, this is not just vague and ethereal. They get very specific information, sometimes even information about how to heal a certain tribe member and that kind of thing, or again, about where to find food, very practical matters. So the shaman does that, goes through these different ceremonies where they are basically adding to the capacity they already have online, but they're using these different kinds of technologies to cross over, obtain information, which obviously involves communication, and then they come back, provide that to the tribe, and the tribe acts accordingly. So really fascinating when you really tune into what's really going on here, what's operationally happening that's allowing for this kind of contact and communication. And once again, following this pattern we've been outlining here, there's a bit of nature and nurture involved. All right, let's move on to the next one, which is dreams. Now, of course, this is something we all experience. You don't have to go through any kind of initiation ritual to learn how to dream. To be human is to dream. Now, what is interesting about this, though, is there's different kinds of dreams. Again, this goes against our conventional thinking and what we're taught, and I'll come to that in a second. But the first thing to point out is that what's interesting about dreams is that our usual evolutionarily derived fight-flight kind of mechanisms kind of go offline. Not completely, but they go largely offline. And so what different non-human intelligences have actually told us that they will often communicate through dreams because that's one of the only modalities they find they can communicate with us through because, again, our consciousness is modulated slightly differently. The setting is slightly different, so the bandwidth access is slightly different, and that allows for a crossover in the range that allows them to communicate with us in a way that we can actually perceive and receive this information. I mentioned on many different podcast episodes that many famous artists, as well as scientists, will talk about receiving downloads or insights in dreams. And again, this is not just tapping into the subconscious, although that's part of it, and not just the personal subconscious, but also the collective unconscious that all humans share as kind of a bedrock. But then even beyond that, the bandwidth goes even further and you have access to non-human intelligences and they can communicate information as well, which again, in conventional circles is not often described or credited as being responsible for some of these innovations and remarkable works of art and inspiration. But that's actually what's happening. And again, it's because in a dream state, we have a slightly different modulation of consciousness that can be utilized by some of these non-human intelligences, as well as the deep subconscious, personal, and collective, to bridge the divide and communicate. Now, what's also interesting, of course, is that we can learn to augment this capacity. For instance, I discussed on different podcasts how I use a supplement called galantamine, along with a certain protocol where I wake up just before I'm about to go into REM, and I actually meditate and hold an intention for a certain kind of experience, less so about the nature of the experience itself, but rather the flavor of the experience. I want it to be positive. I want it to involve encountering benevolent beings, whether they be human or not. So I use that kind of protocol along with this supplement, again, to modulate my consciousness. And this results in some really amazing experiences. I have found this personally. In fact, I wanted to share something that I posted to social media recently regarding one of these experiences I had just this last week, which kind of really synchronistically fits nicely with the topic of this week's episode. I said, quote, "I had a bizarre / stunning experience early this morning when I semi-awoke from a lucid dream. I was then able to watch the ongoing dream in a minimized window to the bottom right of my visual field while my room was projected over the rest of my visual field," unquote. So that's the experience I had. It was really remarkable. I had my eyes mostly open, and in that I could see my room. But in the bottom right, the dream I was having was still unfolding. That's what was remarkable about it. I was driving through the desert, driving this car in this desert road in the high desert. It looked like maybe Oregon or something like that. And I could see this almost like a film roll proceeding while I could also see my room through the rest of my visual field. And this was a dream I had become lucid in already using this protocol that I have established, which other people have used as well, that again involved not just a certain kind of behavior pattern in terms of being prepared for this, meditating, setting an intention, but also by using this supplement, which added to the experience. So again, these two together allow us to modulate our consciousness, and it can produce some really profound experience. Now, before we move on to the next technology of contact, I wanted to first address this notion of there being different kinds of dreams. So again, within indigenous circles that seem to have more nuance around these kinds of matters, they discuss a kind of dream that's known as a big dream. And this refers to dreams that are considered to have deep spiritual or prophetic significance. These dreams are often seen as messages from ancestors, spirits, or the natural world, providing guidance, warnings, or insights, again, about personal and or communal, or even sometimes cosmic events. So again, they actually have more nuance here. So just like we hear about certain, for instance, Inuit tribes that have many, many words for snow because this is part of their felt experience, and so they want more nuance around these kinds of matters. This also comes to dreaming within indigenous cultures as well. They have different kinds of dreams they identify, and a big dream is one that is particularly significant and speaks to sometimes tribal or even cosmic events. Now, the next mediation tool we're going to discuss might be one that surprises you. It might not occur to you that this could be one of these kinds of technologies. And the thing is, it's usually not deliberately used as a consciousness contact technology, although there are some traditions that do try to induce this to use it as a protocol. But I'm aware of people who've had situations where this came into play, of course, not because they meant to do it, but just because it did happen. And after it happened, they indeed had some really profound contact experiences. What I'm referring to here is fever states. So this might surprise you again, but if we think about the underlying mechanism that we've been identifying on this podcast episode, it's that consciousness is modulated in some way. Some sort of change is enacted because of some sort of factor, some variable that is the change agent. In this case, it's some sort of external variable that puts someone in a fever state. And when they're in a fever state, their modulation of consciousness is different. And because of that, they again have a crossover with the bandwidth where some of these other beings exist regularly. And in that, communication can happen. So the most famous case I'm aware of here is with my good friend Stuart Davis. And he actually discussed this on a podcast episode he created where Man Meets Mantis is the name of the title. And that gives you an idea of what happened. He met a mantis being when he was in a fever state. So basically, those of you not familiar, a mantis is a really large, giant, basically version of a praying mantis insect, often 7 to 9 feet tall, pretty imposing creatures. And he met this being for the first time when he was in a fever state. Now, interestingly, if you think this might just be a one-off, it turns out it's not, because when I was visiting him one time in Denver, he actually clarified that he'd had another experience recently at that point. This was a couple of years ago, where he had again encountered this mantis being when he was in a fever state. In this case, it was actually a bad reaction to a vaccine that put him in that fever state. And then he had the encounter again that pretty much picked up where the other one left off. So really fascinating here, what's going on. But again, I think what you're noticing, I hope by this point, is that the mechanism here is the modulation of consciousness, which is caused by different kinds of variables. But once that happens, it changes the bandwidth, and there creates the possibility for an overlap, therefore, with the existence or the regular existence or population of these different beings, and then communication and contact can happen. So really fascinating case, again, through a means or a medium that people often don't think of as a consciousness technology. But again, there are people groups, it's pretty rare, that do try to induce these because of what it will cause. And in fact, you may be aware of situations where even with psychedelics in large doses, can create a pretty strong physiological response, almost like you're trying to fight off something. And of course, this also, though, can induce the possibility for contact and communication. So again, we're seeing some commonality here amongst these different kinds of contact technologies, how it changes our physiology, how it changes our brain structure, and more importantly and more underlyingly, changes the energetic configuration of our consciousness, which allows for these different kind of contact experiences. All right, the next contact technology we're going to discuss is channeling. Now, of course, there are different kinds of channeling, but the channeling I'm going to discuss specifically involves when some sort of non-human intelligence, or at least non-conventionally human intelligence, basically takes over the body, the musculature, and everything, the physiology in total, of the person who they are channeling through. So you have a certain person who volunteers to be the channel, which, as it kind of indicates from the word, becomes the medium by which this happens. But the actual communication in this type of channeling is coming from some other kind of intelligence. They are basically taking over the body after the person has willingly given up that control, and then using the musculature of that person's physiology to actually communicate, to speak. Now, of course, what's interesting here is what we often find is either the intelligence has to use the vocabulary that already exists within that person. So sometimes it might be difficult for them to communicate the fullness of what they're trying to express because of limitations of vocabulary. Or sometimes we do actually find some problems with translation here where the right kind of word can't quite be found. Other times, for instance, in the raw contact material and other kinds of channeling experiences like that, what this entity, or in this case, a collective intelligence, accesses is the entire history of the English language. And that sometimes means they choose words that haven't been used for a couple hundred years that sound very strange to us, and we're very unlikely to be in the mind of the person who is the channel. So again, I think this adds credibility to the notion that some beings can take over this physiology when it's willfully given up and can communicate sometimes with the vocabulary of that person, and sometimes by accessing the collective understanding of humanity around a certain language, which again sometimes results in some pretty strange kinds of words being chosen, strange turn of phrase that we don't really hear in the modern day. So that's channeling. Again, the key is that a different kind of intelligence, like what we discussed with the beings who use dreams, because they find that is a time that they actually can get our attention and communicate. Similarly here, we are put in a certain kind of mode which allows them to communicate with us, this time using our physiology. So that becomes the medium by which this is expressed, which is really, really fascinating. And often the channel, the person who is being channeled through, doesn't even remember the experience. Sometimes they have to listen back to the tape to know for sure what was actually said. And sometimes they're quite shocked by what was actually communicated. And it's very clear to them that they weren't doing this. And of course, they have no memory of doing this. And one last point to make about this. Again, the reason why they don't remember it is because they're basically in a trance-like state. So again, we have the same sort of mechanism where it's the trance-like state that allows for this modulation of consciousness to begin with. So that's channeling, another one of these contact technologies that we can utilize. All right, now let's move on to another one that I think will be quite familiar to those of you familiar with the UFO phenomenon, and that is CE5, or HICE, which stands for Human-Initiated Contact Events, or Contact Experiences. So this basically involves human beings taking the front foot and proactively engaging in communication and contact with non-human intelligences specifically. Now, as many of you know, CE5 is a protocol that was popularized by Dr. Stephen Greer, and this particular contact technology involves meditation, visualization, and group intention. It's known as CE5, or Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, because it's part of a broader classification system for different kinds of UFO encounters. And the first one, of course, CE1, meaning sightings of unidentified flying objects at close range. CE2 refers to finding physical evidence of a UFO. CE3 involves observation of an actual extraterrestrial being or entities in the vicinity of a UFO. Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind, CE4, involves the abduction or direct interaction of a human being with an alien of some sort or another. And then, of course, you have close encounters of the fifth kind, what we're talking about, CE5, which is, again, is human-initiated communication. So something to keep in mind here is what was referenced earlier, and that's the group coherence. So this is really, really key, because if you go out with people who have very different resonance, different kinds of energy that they're sort of emitting into the cosmos, then that's really going to negatively impact the experience likely, because it's the power of the group coherence of that shared intention that basically creates the modulation of consciousness at a group level that tends to make this connection. It's that harmonization that happens around that resonance between benevolent beings and the positive, peaceful intention of the people involved in the CE5 experience. So group coherence is really essential, number one, to increase the strength of the energy that's basically being emitted, and also to modulate the coherence or configuration of that energy, which will harmonize with a certain other kind of being. So again, we have this crossover effect again, where this shared positive intention around benevolent beings that are wanting to be contacted also harmonizes with these very beings. And this can happen often beyond space-time, because again, what sometimes happens is the second these people gather to do this, something appears in the sky, which of course makes you ask the question, did that just happen to be there already and just was sort of predicting this was going to happen, or knew somehow prophetically was going to happen and then showed up on demand? I don't think that's so likely. I think what's more likely is that these kinds of encounters modulate collective consciousness in such a way that it basically transcends space-time and allows us to have these experiences within space-time. So they still populate within the headset, but are actually being triggered with energetic configurations that transcend space-time. And by the way, that was also true of channeling. There have been cases where even the U.S. government is using a certain channel and getting information, as I described, through that kind of channeling mechanism. But then sometimes when they ask for a sign, lights will show up in the sky outside the building. So sometimes not only does information come through, and sometimes the information comes through the physiology of a being, like the channel, but we can also see things populate into the space-time construct by means of a modulation of consciousness that transcends space-time. Now, speaking of group coherence, this is an element that we discuss pretty extensively in my Essence of Being courses, and I wanted to make everyone aware that this upcoming week we'll see the opening of registration for two classes that will be offered starting in September and carrying on into November. They will happen once every week for 12 weeks. The first class is Expanding Awareness. Registration for that will be open midweek. And then there's a follow-up class to that called Cosmic Awakening that is available to anyone who's already taken the first class, Expanding Awareness. Registration for that class will also be opening midweek. And information about these classes and about my Essence of Being initiative in general can be found at essenceofbeing.info. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian or by subscribing on Spotify. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian signing out.